I'm for mystery, not interpretive answers. The answer is never the answer. Ken Kesey. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will go back and listen to our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you, as always, for joining. Again, the support really, really means a lot. This is going to be a little bit shorter episode this week. I kind of wanted to do like a little bridge episode between the areas we were talking about last week and kind of moving into places a little bit further east. But to kind of put a finer point on it, this week we will be talking about the peoples living in what is now kind of the central part of Iran, between 6 and 4,000 BC, or BCE if you prefer. And this will, again, probably be a shorter episode because, sadly, there isn't much concrete stuff to talk about and go over, at least not for someone who does not read any Persian or Arabic. Most of the sources I could find in English on this are very limited. So, and also, it's a little bit older. I couldn't find anything newer than 2010. So kind of take this one with a grain of salt, because I certainly am as well. But that stuff we'll kind of dive into here as we go forward. But this is kind of going to be, again, kind of covering a little bit of a mystery or conjecture or something that's a little odd when it comes to archaeology for the region. Essentially, it's the possibility of an unknown culture that kind of would cover an umbrella of this kind of area that we're going to be discussing. And to that end, I should discuss the geography of this region, and including the Iranian or Persian plateau, depending on, you know, the age of the source you're reading or who's talking about it. And it's also going to be discussing the Zayanda River. But for this episode, I'll use the older name, just because, you know, I'm trying to kind of cover things as they happen, and Persian is the older name. Iran wouldn't be used until much later, so as we get to the more modern periods, I'll probably switch to using the Iranian plateau. But technically speaking, we've talked about parts of this feature in, you know, the last couple of episodes, certainly, and in, you know, earlier seasons. And this is part of the Eurasian tectonic plate that has essentially been jammed in against and between both the Arabian and Indian plates. Basically, any position between the Eastern Caucasus, the Armenian highlands, the Zagros Mountains going east, south of the Kopet Dag Mountains, and west of the Peropamisus Mountains, that's part of the Iranian plateau, or the Persian plateau. And, you know, there are, you know, low-lying valleys and plains inside this geographic area, but most of the region is well above sea level. And the geology and geography makes the region extremely diverse in terms of climate and environment. And, you know, today's episode focuses on a couple of places in kind of the center of this region. And, you know, Homo sapiens have been living there in at least some number since probably as early as 50,000 BC, if not earlier. Now, I know you're wondering, so what? This is true of a lot of places. We've already gone over a couple of them this season. And that's true. But what do all of those places also have that we've discussed this season? And that answer is a material culture. Even if not everyone living in a region truly belongs to said culture, they're at least influenced by it. So why isn't there one in kind of this center region? Especially when they're bordered on all sides by others, and probably we're trading with a couple of them. This region is home to a number of different types of wood, acacia, oak, There is wild fruit trees and things like that in the region that would have been valuable trading sources even to neighbors just two or three valleys over. So why isn't there a larger material culture in this region? Well, that takes us to the Zayanderud or the Zayanda River. And this means the life-giving or the fertile river. And this begins in the Zagros Mountains and flows to the south. Well, it flows east for about 250 miles or 400 kilometers, where it ends up in kind of a large saltwater swamp area, the Gavkoni. And it's smaller at some times of the year, but other times of the year it is much larger, and it's a useful place for, gathering fish and things like that. So it's one of those ectone places. You're kind of in an area where you have a bunch of different biomes. It's a good spot for humans, even if they're not, agriculturalists or pastoralists. They're, for traditional hunter-gatherers, it's a great place to live. Now, this region can get very dry, and this river is very important, especially for modern life. But everywhere that river passes through is going to be a much more comfortable place to live. And the modern city of Isfahan is at the center of the river. It's kind of right in the middle of where that river flows through, and I believe the river runs through the city as well. Now, there are several theories that this region was home to a loosely connected group of villages and nomadic pastoralists, similar to the Dalma culture that we talked about last week. And this is perhaps, or this theoretical concept is unoriginally called the Zayanda River Civilization. Now, again, this is purely hypothetical or conjecture. You won't find much information on it in English either, which again is part of the reason this episode is so short. And even on Wikipedia, there isn't much information. One of the primary links about the culture on that site is broken, and it doesn't link to anything. So that was very frustrating, especially when I read about this culture. And then I find it in several places mention it, but then I find out that, oh no, this is just a theoretical culture. It's hypothetical. So I was like, wait, what? And I went back through it, and I kind of, found out a little bit more. And it does make sense at a theoretical level. You have all these places where you see this new lifestyles enter into the human equation. Pottery's becoming more common and ubiquitous among people. And you have this region that, while dry and arid, does have some land that would be decent for crops and things like that. And you have a region that's teeming with the kind of shrubs and things like that, where it'd be a great place for nomadic herdsmen, especially those with sheep and goats and things like that, ungulates. But there isn't a culture in this region, and there should be. If you look at the kind of cultures that are rising in other places, they have very similar types of environment in some of them. Some of them are, of course, much more fertile. But there's nothing that's preventing people in this region from having some type of culture. In fact, the region's fairly hard to get into, but there are people living here. We know that. And in decent numbers, too. So why isn't there some type of really big kind of centralizing site that, is kind of affecting the others or sending out colonist groups and things like that? So we may well find some type of site that shows, okay, yeah, all these places are connected in some way. Now, It could be very loose connection. It could be more of a confederation than anything, rather than kind of like a mother city, or, you know, people reestablishing links through marriage or trade or things like that. But the idea that, you know, this place couldn't have a civilization is laughable if you look at everywhere else in the Near East at this time. So, again, I think it's very possible that there is a culture. There just hasn't been evidence found of it yet. However, there is one site that stands out at this early stage of this season it doesn't stand alone because it doesn't really have anything that makes it unique from other Neolithic sites. It is kind of like I hate to use the phrase, but it is a generic Neolithic site, but it is kind of on its own. And that is the site of Tepe Siak. And this means Silk Hill, though the site is actually two hills, a northern hill and a southern hill. And it is about 160 miles, which is like 250 kilometers north of Isfahan. And it was first occupied on a permanent basis around 6000 BC. And it was occupied for around 500 years. And this is a very simplistic site, and it's concentrated on the northern mound for this period. And it seems they had, you know, very simple homes made of mud. I wasn't sure if it was mud or mud brick. There is a little discrepancy in some of the literature I've read. But they practiced at least a small level of agriculture. It seems they were much more reliant on herding, but they did have some crops. And they're also making their own pottery, and it's very rough stuff. You know, uneven. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's functional. It's useful. It's not shoddily made. It's just they didn't have time probably to really focus on the aesthetic quality of it. That does change, though, over time. After a couple hundred years, it does become smoother, and they begin to paint it simply. Not any designs, as far as I'm aware. They kind of just whitewash it, essentially. But there may be some lines. I wasn't sure about the exact dating on those earliest pots. But, you know, again, it's like the start of a civilization, or at least not a civilization, but it's the start of a material culture, almost, that we see at some of these other places. They also have copper. There is evidence that they are doing the simple cold rolling type, basically the early experimentation, treating copper much like stone. However, this is happening just before the site is abandoned. Aside from that, I couldn't really find out much about the site. I didn't find mention of population. I didn't see anything about burial practices. But anyway, eventually, after 500 years, the site's abandoned. Why? We don't know. There's no evidence of destruction, at least the type of destruction that leaves a lair. Usually that means burning. But there's nothing like that at the site. So it's probably either environmental or, possibly they had just used up all their grazing lands and the agricultural yield wasn't enough to kind of make staying there worth it. Or maybe there's the rain and the precipitation in the area, the environment just changed in some way. Or maybe it's a mix of the causes. Who knows? But eventually, people do return to the site, at least for brief periods of time. Nothing like the 500-year occupation we see. It seems like they may have used it for a year or two, then they left and came back, and this is kind of continues on and off over the centuries. Until right around 4000 BC, possibly a little earlier, maybe sometime between 4300, 4100, it's kind of hard to say. But by 4000 BC at the latest, the site is reoccupied fully. And when it is reoccupied, it is already as advanced as the earlier site had been at the time it was abandoned. Probably actually more advanced, to be quite honest. Their pottery is much more developed, and they are, again, working with copper much more expertly. And it seems like they had a better time producing food. Now, we will talk about this site more in depth next season, or at least this phase of the site. But it is probably being founded, or at least, I should say, it's probably being founded by outsiders, or at least people who were quickly falling under the cultural sway of their neighbors to the west. There is evidence that they have ties to the Uruk culture and other parts of Iran. So it's possible that, you know, one of these places sent out colonists, or the people refounding Tepe Siyalk are kind of under pressure from these peoples, or not necessarily under pressure, but they're being heavily influenced by them, and they decide, hey, we should found a site like this. And Tepe Siyalk is, it's not near the Zandia River, but it is close to a natural spring. And these are very important for this region in Iran. There are a number of places that rely on what will eventually be called Qanats. These are kind of ancient Persian aqueducts. They kind of serve a similar purpose, but they take use of spring waters, natural spring water from the ground. And Siyalk was probably maybe relying on something like that earlier. And there's a famous spring in the area that is, I believe, still in use today. But we'll get into that. Once it is refounded, it will also become a major site for metallurgy. In addition to being very good copper workers, or at least having access to a lot of well-made copper, it's also going to be one of the first sites in Central or West Asia, depending on what you consider this part of the world, to work silver. But again, that is stuff that we will focus on next time. Now, there are other sites kind of in this region. The problem with those are, and it's not necessarily a problem, but the issue with kind of tying them in to this time period is that a lot of these places in this part of Iran have been continuously occupied. And they're basically still excavating you know, some of these very rich sites. They haven't really gotten further than 3000 BC. I know there's a site called Marvdasht. It is very old. They think it could have been occupied around the same time as Tepe Siyalk. And there is evidence of a connection between Tepe Siyalk and Marvdasht at this earlier period. There is kind of very similar pottery at both of these early sites, and these shards of pottery have been found along parts of the Zandia River, which is, again, part of the reason why they think there's probably some type of culture connecting them. Work is still being done to excavate these places. And again, unfortunately, I can't read some of the newer pieces of research that have been done. Marvdasht, again, it could have been continually occupied for, you know, since 6000 BC. And I still think it's technically occupied, or at least the modern city of Marvdasht is very close to the archaeological site. It's not exactly the same location. They're like a couple of kilometers/miles from each other. Numerous sites are, you know, of other cities are also part of that region. Several of them have been abandoned, or they were sacked, and then the population moved a couple of miles away, and then they moved back later. It's just one of those things. But this entire kind of central region of the Persian plateau will be home to a number of kingdoms and states that will be very important in world history. The Medes, the original tribe of the Persians that succeeded the Medes, the one that the Achaemenid Empire comes from. This is kind of like one of the heartlands of Iranian civilization when we get there. So, yeah, there is, you know, clear connection between these sites, but it's just a question of how closely connected are they? Are they, you know, do they see a kinship with each other, or are they each their own thing, and they each take influence from their closest neighbors? It's hard to really get into, especially at this very, very early stage of human history, or prehistory. But that's all stuff that we'll, of course, get into in much more detail next season. Now, next week, I will have the episode out. At least my goal is to have it out on time. It is a long weekend here in the U.S. for Martin Luther King holiday. I will be traveling, but I do plan on bringing my equipment to record where I'm going. It may be slightly late. I'm not sure yet, but I will have an episode out at on Monday at some point. But yeah. Sorry that this one is a little shorter. Sorry it's a little bit rougher. I can only work with what I can find. But we'll be moving west from here, or excuse me, east from here. So we'll probably talk about places in Afghanistan. Maybe we'll get into Pakistan too, but that's just something we'll have to wait and see on. But regardless, that is a region that both of those, or at least the region that both of those modern countries occupy, there is definite cultural connection and trade links. But again, that's all stuff we'll go over next week. But I'd like to thank you all for joining me. I hope you've enjoyed. If you have any questions or comments or constructive criticism, please feel free to reach out to me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can also contact me via direct message on Twitter/X. You can comment on the YouTube videos. I do stream pretty much every day on YouTube, at least during the week. Some weekends I don't, if I'm out of town or super busy. You know, if you subscribe there, you're welcome to drop in if you see me live. You can say hey, you can ask questions there. You cannot drop links, but you can at least kind of give me a description of what you're trying to link to. And we're over 200 subscribers on YouTube. We just hit 202 a little bit earlier this week. And so it's channel's still growing, which is nice. And we're still getting good downloads. I think we're I haven't counted recently, but I believe we're over 10,000 total. So appreciate you all, and I hope I'll see you all next week. You all have a good rest of your day and the rest of your week, and I'll see y'all next time. Peace.